This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, just a few weeks left for shopping for Hanukkah and Christmas, but we want to remind our listeners there's even less time to shop for health insurance for 2018 on the insurance marketplace. Business is brisk on the exchanges, approaching 4 million signups so far. December 15th is the last day for the health exchange, which is covering some 39 states this year. Some state-based exchanges have extended open enrollment by adding an extra week, but for most Americans, December 15th is the final day you can sign up for coverage for next year.
And we're learning some interesting things during this current open enrollment period. Consumers who have a couple of years of experience are now much better equipped, it seems, to navigate the online health insurance marketplaces. And we've seen record numbers of consumers sign up for coverage right at the start of the open enrollment period. A lot of motivation out there.
A lot of motivation, but a lot less time. And that's a real concern for those fighting in the trenches to get the word out across the country. And we'll repeat the website again, healthcare.gov.
There are trained navigators who are available to guide you through the process as well to answer your questions, though their numbers are much fewer this year due to reductions in funding. And we hear that people who are seeking assistance to complete their online applications are getting through to the navigators. Please do it again, healthcare.gov.
Maybe a little extra time on hold, but it's well worth it to make sure you and your family are covered and you get the tax subsidies you deserve. And close to 80% of those who purchased insurance on the exchange receive some kind of tax subsidy to offset the cost. If you buy insurance in the private exchanges, you won't qualify for that.
And speaking of ways that we use online portals for healthcare purposes, that brings us to our guests today. Brothers Dr. Ido Schoenberg and Dr. Roy Schoenberg are the co-founders of American Well, a telemedicine support company that is now one of the big players in telehealth. They've recently partnered with Apple to conduct an innovative new large-scale health study. The Apple Heart Study is seeking data on the prevalence of atrial fibrillation, a heart arrhythmia, and a common health problem in this country, one that often goes undetected and is a leading cause of stroke.
The Schoenberg brothers lead American Well, which is providing a telemedicine component to the study. It's a very interesting development, and we're looking forward to hearing more about it, Margaret.
And Lori Robertson will be stopping by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Roy and Ido Schoenberg of American Well in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. While sign up for health insurance for 2018 on the insurance marketplaces shuts down December 15th, some folks may get an extension. Handful of states have extended open enrollment till December 22nd. But for those purchasing insurance on the federal exchange, December 15th is your last chance to apply for coverage. But there are some exceptions. If people are signing up for plans that don't exist in 2018 that did in 2017, the health law allows for a special enrollment period. Also, there are a couple of other circumstances, such as change in marital status or employment. But this year's got something different as well. People who were impacted by the hurricanes in Puerto Rico, Texas, and the Southeast are eligible for extensions as well. There's long been evidence supporting a link between birth control pills and breast cancer, but a more recent study reveals the risk could be just as pervasive in low-dose birth control. A decade-long study looked at 1.8 million Danish women, comparing cancer rates among those women who'd been on the long-term low-dose birth control. Study revealed a small but statistically significant link between hormone-based birth control use and increased risk of breast cancer. The study didn't take into account other risk factors, alcohol intake, lack of exercise, whether a woman breastfed or not, all known factors. But the study did reveal that even newer, lower-dose formulations carry an elevated breast cancer risk. Researchers saying, considering the millions of women around the world who rely on birth control, this study should raise some concern. Huntington's disease is a devastating sentence, having been described as a combination of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's rolled into one. impacting neural and mental capabilities before attacking the body. And at the moment, there's no available treatment other than drugs to treat some of the symptoms. But researchers at the City College of London have had some dramatic success with a new approach, injecting a new compound into the spinal column that lowers the level of the toxic proteins said to fuel Huntington's. Results in the initial trials were so dramatic, the drug maker Ionis Pharmaceuticals has opted to license the drug ahead of more large-scale trials. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Roy Schoenberg, President and CEO of American Well, and his brother and co-founder, Dr. Ido Schoenberg, Chairman and CEO of American Well, a telehealth service company whose mission is to improve access to quality care, to make it more transparent and affordable. Previously, the brothers co-founded CareKey, a provider of advanced care management software, which was acquired by TriZetto Group, where Ido Schoenberg served as Chief Business Strategy Officer. Dr. Roy Schoenberg was the 2014 recipient of the American Telemedicine Association Award for Leadership in the Field of Telemedicine. Roy Schoenberg earned his medical degree from Hebrew University and MPH from Harvard. Ido Schoenberg earned his MD from the Sackler School of Medicine. Ido and Roy, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare, and thank you for being with us. And Roy,
thanks for having us.
Certainly. Roy, I want to start off with you. You've both been leading in the health information technology field, and there's been a lot of buzz recently about the latest collaboration, a new type of heart study in partnership with Apple and Stanford. And I wonder if you could tell us more about the Apple Heart Study and the role American Well is going to play in it.
Sure, Mark. The truth is that I think the press coverage around the heart study has been tremendous. I think a lot of people got excited about telemedicine over the last couple of years. It has really skyrocketed in terms of adoption and use and value. But if you kind of try to realize what just happened and what corner telemedicine has gone by when the Apple Heart Study was announced, you know, if you think about the way that medicine has always been, there were really two ways in which medicine intervened. Either we showed up when we were very sick, or in some ways, healthcare developed ways in which occasionally, if we were, you know, willing to do so, it would take a snapshot of where we are and try to identify early certain diseases, people that do colonoscopies or women that need to do mammogram, you know, at a certain age. But with a heart study, we kind of crossed a certain line because for the first time, we're saying healthcare is not going to wait until you show up with a certain healthcare condition, but rather we're actually going to go to where you are. We're going to kind of live with you and try to do our best as we walk through life with you to understand whether certain things that are happening with you and your body may indicate that some kind of treatment or some kind of intervention is needed. That's a radical, radical departure in the philosophy of how we do medicine. And I think this is really the corner that the Apple Heart Study signifies.
Well, Ido, I think it's a fair assumption that the 33 million Apple Watch users are likely to be more highly motivated, perhaps, than other health consumers. So I'm wondering, how many participants are you expecting to engage with the Heart Study? And how are you preparing clinicians to respond to what could be a significant volume of patients seeking medical advice because of what turns up? Are you developing a cadre of clinicians to respond specifically to these issues?
Yeah, it's very difficult to predict the exact level of utilization of the study. And as you can imagine, we did think through many scenarios in American Well to try to support those amazing organizations, Apple and Stanford, in the best possible way. But I think that if we look back and see this as a greater phenomena, we see something pretty amazing, and that is that, as far as I know, it's the first time that a tool that is used by consumers, which inherently is not a medical device, can be so instrumental to help us understand something that could have a potential far-reaching clinical impact. What we hope the study will be able to show that we will be able to find people that could warrant medical attention far sooner than any other medical intervention that is much more proactive in the daily life of people. And so we have this tool that we use every day that listens to our body, and we have this most sophisticated algorithm that presents some of the most sophisticated clinical thinking in the nation. Not everybody have access to the best thought leaders in Stanford every day in every place in America. But now, in a very democratic way, everybody could benefit from that type of thinking. And then we are able to close the loop with board-certified providers that show up much quicker than any other alternative to help navigate and understand the finding. And that, to me, is the core innovation.
I think our listeners would be intrigued by your longtime collaboration as brothers, physicians, and innovators. And I wonder if you could tell them about how you both got started together on this path to innovation and applying new technologies to the healthcare space. What were the origins of it? What influenced you to delve into health informatics and the telehealth arena specifically?
I think in big capital letters, constructive, you know, sibling rivalry really helps. But if I kind of go back, it really hasn't been kind of a eureka, cerebral process of finding what it is that we want to do. Everything that we've done through the three companies came from a kind of a visceral experience as human beings that made us consider, is there a way to make things better? To remove an obstacle from something that we did. Just to give you a sense, both of us are physicians. When we were young during our training, one of the things that a young training physician does is spend the night in an intensive care unit. And if you ever spend the night, there are all of these machines and instruments that yell at you that something is going wrong with the patients in their beds, and it's a very scary experience. The first company that we constructed was a company that essentially said, why can't we connect a computer to all of these alarms and alerts and try to algorithmically make sense out of them so that if all of them together are actually indicating that something is wrong with the patient, only then we start screaming at the young physicians who are spending the night at the ICU trying to help. So the fear drove us to develop, you know, the first company. The second company was something also very human. We were running around between, you know, as patients. You know, you walk from one physician to the other, and the other one doesn't have your record and needs to do your blood tests again. And the second company that was created was all about, can we just pass records to where patients go rather than have patients go to where the records are? In American Well, which is, you know, what we've been doing for the last decade when it started, you know, you could get a lot of things done over the web. You had the Expedia of the world where you can get tickets to fly somewhere. You had Amazon to buy stuff that you wanted. You had online banking. You could order food. All of these services have one thing in common. They deliver some goods to you. And in healthcare at the time, the only thing you could do is actually read articles. Goods in healthcare, which for most of us is seeing a physician, that thing was not possible through online services. And when we started American Well, it was exactly the mission statement of the company to create the capability to do just that.
Well, you've also been pragmatically working on the monetization of telemedicine protocols for a while as well. And I see great value in making costs more transparent and also trying to, maybe you could share with us some of the challenges that you faced overcoming regulatory hurdles and some of the entrenched industry standards, as well as just that we've always done it this way. And why do you think the system now is finally ready for this kind of disruption?
Well, when we started, many people were very concerned about telehealth. You cannot feel the patient. You cannot put a hand on someone's body and provide a physical examination. Some doctors were worried that their relationship with their trusting patient is going to be influenced. Some states were concerned about competition across state lines. You know, in theory, I can go home and there is nothing good on television. Wouldn't it be fantastic for me to talk to some great doctors? And the health plan and the employer would need to pay for it. So a lot of the resistance that we've seen actually in many cases had a lot of merit. And in many ways, some of the services of telehealth today are not made equal. I mean, I would agree that if I'm talking to someone that I never met, only to see me one time and provide a prescription, this type of interaction has very limited value. And that's not what we're trying to do. I think that a lot of the reasons why you begin to see telehealth today is a combination of the cost of healthcare is enormous, mm-hmm. and it's not sustainable. The access is really broken. People spend too long waiting to see a doctor and pay too much. And these are very, very strong drivers to try to create a new model. But the solution is not to find a cheaper doctor. That would be a really bad idea. But the solution revolves around true efficiencies that are possible when care is moving into the cloud. So essentially, our mission is not necessarily to help people find a quick doctor in a box in a cloud and get a prescription. Our mission is to help our trusted doctors to treat patients who are not in the room. What American Well is doing is trying to take the community of providers that we trust, the hospitals that we know, the doctors in our communities, and allow them to interact in a way that is fully reimbursed and is safe and secure with the patients that they interact with, and allow this to be financed by the different types of payers in the system, and allow smart innovators like Stanford and Apple to say, okay, now that care is possible in the cloud, how can we use this opportunity to truly improve care?
We're speaking today with Dr. Roy Schoenberg, President and CEO, and Dr. Ido Schoenberg, Chairman and CEO of American Well. They've recently partnered with Apple and Stanford to conduct a new heart health study utilizing Apple Watch research kit and American Well's telemedicine platform. Roy, I like what you said earlier about your focus. We want to make things better. And I'm sure that's one of the reasons you've won accolades from the American Telemedicine Association for your work to create telehealth standards and guidelines for the industry. I wonder if you can tell our listeners what you've learned in this process and how both the regulatory and payment landscapes have evolved to better support the adoption of telemedicine.
Well, Mark, that's an excellent question on how do you squeeze 11 years of battles into a, you know, 1 minute answer. But where we started off, you know, when we started American Well a little bit over 10 years ago, the first time that we deployed the telehealth solution that we created, which was with our long-lasting partner, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Hawaii, in the state of Hawaii, on the day that it was rolled out, there was a message to all physicians in Hawaii, if you do this thing that's called telehealth, your license may be revoked. Mm-hmm. This is where this was the starting point of the history. And of course, things have changed dramatically. But I think just about 5 years ago, the change in perception for the first 5 years of the journey, people thought of telehealth as an alternative kind of medicine. And as you can imagine, that created a tremendous amount of fear of disintermediation and that someone's going to take people's jobs away or physicians or their relationship. And just around 5 years ago, with support by the Federation of State Medical Boards and others, people started realizing that telehealth isn't a different kind of healthcare, but rather a different channel for the traditional healthcare. Telehealth is not a product. It's a way to redistribute mm-hmm. the good healthcare that was developed in this country for, you know, for hundreds of years. And the moment that people started realizing it, that this is not a different kind of healthcare, a lot of the fear, a lot of the animosity started subsiding. And what we've seen that do is that pretty much all of the key institutes that drive healthcare in this country started pivoting, started moving. The payers, the health insurance companies, started introducing telehealth into their benefits. The hospitals started introducing telehealth into their patient portals and the way that they promote themselves. Physicians started bringing it into their daily workflows, and the regulators, which are kind of late, you know, politics apparently is always kind of late in the game, started changing the language of a lot of antiquated rules to say, yes, healthcare, good healthcare can happen when the patient and the physician see each other, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they have to sit in the same room under the same roof. And this is the biggest change that I think allowed the domino effect that caused that kind of breakneck growth we're seeing now in telehealth.
Well, I would love for you to comment a little bit on what you've learned from consumers. in this process? What have they told you about what they love, what they'd like to see changed, and what they'd like to see that maybe doesn't exist yet in this telemedicine venture that you've created?
You know, what we've heard from consumer over the years are really two things. First of all, make healthcare less painful for us. It needs to be easier to consume. It needs to be more convenient. It needs to be immediate. It needs to be transparent. It needs to be at the same cost or below of the services that we usually get. And if you can do all of that kind of stuff and maintain quality, we're in. And then on the flip side, the other consumers of telehealth, which are the providers, have said that platform has to resonate with consumers to make sure that they find us, the brands that they trust to deliver the best healthcare through this kind of technology. And once we've built a system such that consumer gets all of those capabilities and on them the brands that they trust, we started seeing everybody becoming very happy and cheerfully using the system.
You know, I want to pick up on part of what Margaret just asked about what doesn't exist. And maybe a question for both of you, Roy and Ido. What are the greatest opportunities out there for disruption, and maybe what challenges need to be solved to get there?
You know, people talk a lot about telehealth, but the truth of the matter is that only 3% or so of Americans are using it. And it's really interesting to think about why, because in theory, it's convenient, it's affordable. And in our opinion, there are a few things that are still missing. The most important thing is that the service needs to be trusted. When you talk to a call center and you never select the doctor that is speaking with you, and you never can call him again and he cannot see you and doesn't have an access to your record, of course that many people are concerned about interacting with such a service. One of the important drivers for ubiquity is going to allow an infrastructure that will connect my doctor looking at the screen that they look at every day and fully paid for by the payers to interact with patients who are not in the room. The second element relates to awareness. Consumers can get telehealth in one of three places: the intranet of your employer, the app you never knew your hospital had, or the website of your health insurance company. I'm sure you agree those are not perfectly suited places to engage with your doctor. Mm-hmm. What we are going to see coming quite soon is some of the people that really know how to present options to consumers taking part in this process. Wouldn't it be great if one day I can wake up in the morning and say, hey, Bixby, or Alexa or Siri, I have a headache, I have a symptom, I have a concern, and I would like an environment that is truly consumer-focused to present my clinical and financial options, and I want to be able to choose from things that we trust. So these are two things that are truly happening in front of our eyes right now, which are some of the remaining barriers. When you move care online, there are so many new things that you could do. There are so many efficiencies, financial and clinical, that are simply not possible when you go to a certain room and talking to one person rather than creating a data-rich, interactive collaboration that happens in cyberspace. These are two things that are truly happening in front of our eyes right now, which are some of the remaining barriers. The other thing that is happening is that when you move care online, there are so many new things that you could do in order to improve care. There are so many efficiencies, financial and clinical, that are simply not possible when you go to a certain room and talking to one person rather than creating a data-rich, interactive, multidisciplinary collaboration that happens in cyberspace.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Roy Schoenberg, President and CEO, and Dr. Ido Schoenberg, Chairman and CEO of American Well, a telehealth services company whose mission is to improve access to quality care and to make it more transparent and affordable for consumers by using mobile and web technology. You can learn more about their work by going to AmericanWell.com or follow them on Twitter at American Well. Drs. Schoenberg, thank you so much for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you very much.
Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lurie Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lurie, what have you got for us this week?
The House and Senate have both passed tax overhaul legislation. They're now working on reconciling the differences in the two bills in a conference committee. Let's take a look at provisions in the bills pertaining to health care. The House bill would repeal, and the Senate bill makes some changes to, a medical expense deduction. Under current law, those who itemize their taxes can deduct out-of-pocket medical expenses that go above 10% of adjusted gross income. So if your adjusted gross income was $40,000 and you and your spouse and any dependents had unreimbursed medical expenses of $6,000, you could deduct $2,000 of those expenses. For tax year 2016, there was a temporary exemption for those age 65 and older, allowing them to deduct medical expenses that exceeded 7.5% of adjusted gross income. But that exemption went away in 2017. The House bill eliminates the deduction entirely. The Senate bill lowers the threshold to 7.5% of adjusted gross income in 2017 and 2018 and reverts to the current law in 2019. An estimated 8.8 million tax filers claimed a medical expense deduction in tax year 2015, according to IRS data, and those filers deducted a total of $87 billion in expenses. The Senate bill repeals the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate penalty, which individuals without health insurance must pay unless they qualify for an exemption. The House bill doesn't change the mandate penalty. In tax year 2015, 6.7 million people paid a penalty for not having health insurance. Those payments totaled $3.1 billion. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lurie Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lurie Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When venture capitalist and Shark Tank co-host Mark Cuban decides to sink a couple of hundred thousand dollars into your business idea, taking a very small percentage of the company in return, you're probably onto something. And that's what happened to Olivier Noel, a medical student and young geneticist at the University of Pennsylvania, when he appeared on the popular ABC show. Through his research and studies, Noel learned that no matter how many resources a clinical study has, it is still extremely difficult to get a large sample of participants to join in studies. There are many barriers to getting a good cross-section of study participants. So he thought, what if you could simplify the process, eliminate the barriers to research participation, and build up a rich DNA database for future research all at the same time? And he created DNA Simple because he wanted to make it, well, simple.
There's not really a formalized way for people to just participate in research studies and provide samples remotely. So the idea was to create a database where if you are anywhere in the States, you could participate in a research study. That could easily be done by providing a saliva sample.
All the participants have to do is to take a simple swab of the inside of the mouth, send it in, and wait to see if your specific DNA is of interest to researchers. The company will make their DNA and data available to researchers studying specific diseases, offering a much broader spectrum of study participants. And the study participants themselves receive an extra something for choosing to participate, a cash stipend for offering up their DNA to research.
So every time you participate, you know, you send a sample back to us, we mask your address and send it to the researchers, and then we send you a check, we send you $50 to your address. If there's money in it, I think everyone should be able to get a little piece.
DNA Simple has gotten a big boost from the Shark Tank win, and they're scaling up the infrastructure to expand their DNA database to represent as broad a demographic spectrum as possible.
We want to be the place where you could automatically think of, if you're thinking of a study and need a population, that it's like a go-to, whether you need DNA samples. And now urine and stool samples, actually. sort of be a go-to spot for when you're thinking of a study and eliminate that worry of, oh, I'm not going to do this because I may not be able to get the samples.
DNA Simple, a vetted database linking researchers with a broad array of participants to enhance lab research by eliminating the barriers to finding participants. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.